Good afternoon and welcome to HealthCetera. I'm Kenya Beard, one of the co-producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, the City University of New York. Today on HealthCetera, we will continue to delve deeper into the causes of race-based inequalities, the racial or ethnic differences in the quality of care that some groups receive. Now, typically, I have focused on race-based inequalities that have been widely documented and studied. I've raised the critical question, why do minorities or individuals from low-income groups who have diabetes or hypertension, why do they have higher rates of stroke and end-stage renal disease? Well, we know the reasons are multifactorial. What we know now is that what an individual does or does not do is not the only factor that influences their healthcare outcomes. Another plausible reason that's disconcerting, but nevertheless could affect how individuals are cared for, is implicit bias, the subconscious beliefs or attitudes that can affect how you're treated and influence your outcomes. Well, on today's show, we are going to shift our focus away from the more common illnesses like diabetes and hypertension, and we're going to discuss an area of race-based inequalities that's gaining a lot of traction: trauma-based disparities. If you are between the ages of 1 to 46, trauma is the number one cause of death, and every year close to 200,000 people lose their life to trauma. The economic burden is startling, close to $600 billion a year. All around, the price is hefty. But when we talk about disparities, do differences in outcomes for individuals who suffer a traumatic event exist? So if you're an African American or Hispanic, or an individual who lacks insurance, who, let's say, is in a car accident and receives a head injury, or is stabbed or shot, could there be a difference in the way you are treated? Well, to answer that question, I have invited Dr. Adil Haider onto the show. He is the man who is responsible for a lot of the attention around trauma-based disparities. Adil is an active trauma and critical care surgeon who spends a lot of time caring for individuals who have sustained traumatic injuries. He has practiced for many years at Johns Hopkins before moving up north and becoming the director of the Center for Surgery and Public Health at Brigham and Women's Hospital. I am so honored to have Adil on the show, not only because he is a prolific researcher who is recognized as the pioneer in the field of trauma disparities research and is credited with uncovering racial disparities after traumatic injury, but because his professional goal, like mine, is to eradicate healthcare disparities in the U.S. Adil, welcome to HealthCetera.
Thank you very much, Kenya. It's a real pleasure to be on your show, and I'm really excited to be able to chat with you and lend a voice to this important issue to all of your listeners across the country.
So, Adil, as I mentioned earlier, we've spoken a lot on the show about disparities related to diabetes and hypertension, but your research looks at disparities in the field of trauma. So first, what compelled you as a surgeon to explore this area of research?
Kenya, trauma surgery, as you mentioned, or trauma in America, is almost a silent epidemic. It is, as you've pointed out rightly, the number one killer of people between the ages of 1 and, 44, and also even perhaps more importantly, since a lot of young people are impacted by this, the years of potential life lost. So, for example, if you have a person who's 18 and they get paralyzed, then their entire productive life loss up to age 65 is wasted, right?
That's right.
So if you add those up, the impact of trauma far supersedes any disease like cardiac disease or cancer and so on. It far supersedes that. So trauma, number one, is a huge issue. And then secondly, Most people, including myself, when I was training to be a trauma surgeon, assumed that disparities wouldn't affect trauma, right? Because, you know, we don't check your insurance when you're brought into the hospital by an ambulance after a car crash.
Right.
You know, typically we don't care who you are, what you look like, and we supposedly provided the same care to everybody. But there were some pieces of information coming through that for younger children who, for example, were injured in the inner city versus younger kids who were in the suburbs, and so in the suburbs mostly white kids and in the inner cities mostly black kids, the black kids were getting a shorter observation and a less invasive, if you will, not invasive, but a less extensive workup after falling or after having a head injury. So like the suburban kids were getting CAT scans and so on, whereas the kids in the emergency department in inner cities were not having any of that. And so we had this worry that maybe there's a difference in outcome. And at the same time, I personally was kind of going through this thing where I had the opportunity to go work in Africa and come back when I was finishing my training as a trauma surgeon. And one of my mentors said to me, you know, you don't need to go to Africa to take care of people who really need you. There are people right up the street in Baltimore who could really use your help.
Wow.
And that was, yeah, wow. You know, that was a real eye-opener. And, you know, we started looking into this field and found startling results, as you mentioned, that, you know, minority children had much worse functional outcomes after traumatic injury. And we found that, you know, compared to white children, black children had a significantly increased disability in walking, talking, and the ability to eat after a traumatic injury to the head compared to similarly injured white children. So that was our first kind of thing we found, and it's been nearly 10 years since we showed that result.
So why is it that if an African-American child or a white child has a traumatic injury, brain injury, why would the black child have less functional outcomes or more disabilities? What are we doing differently? How has your research informed you?
Well, you know, this was obviously, as a clinician, when you find such results, you try to relate it to patients that you've cared for and see, you know, what in my own practice could explain this. And I'll go back to a situation where I had the opportunity to care for a young woman early on in my career who was shot. And, you know, she was very badly injured. Let's put it this way. Her heart stopped beating on the operating room table. But we were able to get her back, get her heart restarted. Mm-hmm. She required, you know, maybe 40, 50 units of blood, multiple operations, in the ICU for a long time. And then she then got to the floor. She was doing okay, but at maybe day number 17. So, you know, she was in the ICU. She was, you know, had 3-4 different operations, was in the ICU for about 12 days, was on the floor for about, you know, on day 17, she basically starts refusing all care, so to speak. She's like, I don't want anybody touching me. I don't want anybody drawing any blood. I don't want anybody coming near me. And now, let me put this in perspective. This was the first time I was operating alone, right? So mm-hmm. I was a brand new trauma surgeon. I spent my entire life training to do this job. And it wasn't just me. It's an entire team of people who do this, right? There are 40, 50 people on the team. And many people, including myself, felt, you know, why is this happening? Why is this person, you know, who we spent so much effort trying to save, is now doesn't want to have anything to do with me or do with us? And people use adjectives such as, you know, ungrateful or, you know, all sorts of things that you can imagine.
Right, right.
And, but the thing is, Kenya, I completely missed the boat. You know, this was a young girl. And because she came from a area that has endemic violence, you know, we assumed that, you know, this happens to everybody. But no, this young woman was suffering from severe PTSD.
Wow.
I guess you can't diagnose PTSD, but severe post-traumatic stress syndrome that early on. It's not disorder until it's
right.
6 months. But that's what it was. And anytime anybody spoke to her or touched her, you know, she would get really she would get really upset until we spent the time. And, you know, I basically sat in a room for like hours and said, you tell me what's going on, because we're not going to let this go. And then eventually she kind of came out of her shell and started to, you know, explain what was going on. And the first psychiatrist we had talked to her, of course, didn't talk to her about her problems, started talking about, you know, her family history and some, you know, things which are not normal in society that were related to her family history, and what had nothing to do with her current injury. And by the way, we knew that she was actually taken hostage. So this young woman was taken hostage by another perpetrator who was also shot, by the way. And it was a crazy day. It was like out of the movies. You know, she was
what
dying on the walk table.
I had, story.
Yeah. I was in the other room. I took the other guy, started his operation, got another trauma surgeon. He started operating on him, and I ran back to this room and got her heart restarted. I mean, it was like out of the movie. And we knew all that. And still, we didn't give her the benefit of the doubt that we should have, right?
And why do you think it was so hard to give her the benefit of the doubt and that we raced to judge and use words like ungrateful?
Right. Well, I think it is because of unfamiliarity of where the person is coming from. You know, this implicit preference that you're talking about, it's much more easier for us to relate to people who have the same social circumstances and experiences that we have. So suppose somebody who looks just like me, grew up where I grew up, went to the same institutions, country clubs, if you will, that I've been to, you know, I'll be able to understand where that person's coming from much better than, you know, I never knew anybody who had been shot. I mean, I've taken care of a lot of patients who've been shot, but I had never known anybody personally where I grew up in the Midwest. And after this experience, I got to really spend more and more time with my patients. First of all, in surgical training, you know, you're always rushing. You never get the chance to, like, sit and talk to people.
Right.
But when I became a trauma attending, I got the chance to talk to people. I got the chance to sit in clinic with people and understand their perspective and where they're coming from. And then, of course, all this other data started coming about racial disparity, where we realized that, you know, when you ask somebody to lose weight or eat healthy if they have diabetes, but then you send them back to the same environment where there is no place to buy that kind of food, then how are we upset that, oh, the person coming from the suburbs who has all sorts of access to Whole Foods and can actually buy stuff at Whole Foods, that person is very compliant versus the patient who's not in an environment where they can be compliant, and then we blame them for not being compliant. So
right.
That thing doesn't, yeah, that's not just for chronic conditions, that's also in trauma care, and this was kind of our first foray into it. And then what we did is we did a lot more work to really understand what's going on. And I'll give you a couple of numbers if that's okay with you.
Sure, go ahead.
So this was the first study you talked about was for kids. But for adults, we looked at severely injured patients who, you know, and we made the gold standard group white patients with insurance. Now, comparing a white patient with insurance to a black patient with insurance, who has very similar injuries, nearly equivalent injuries. The black patient, despite having insurance, is 20% more likely to die. These are for adults after a severe traumatic injury.
But I thought you said earlier, when they come in, we're not checking insurance. We're just right to the emergency care and meeting
uh-huh.
their needs.
And that's why we needed to understand what was driving this. And it's even more. So Hispanic patients, 50%. More likely to die, even if they have insurance. And if there is a patient who's a minority and doesn't have insurance, it's even worse. So compared to a white patient who has insurance, a black patient who doesn't have insurance is about 70% more likely to die. And even amongst the white patients, if you have a white patient who has insurance versus a white patient who doesn't have insurance, you know, the patient who doesn't have insurance is 50% more likely to die. So we did a lot of work to understand, you know, why this happens. And we focused on, you know, many different aspects, including unconscious preference, like you mentioned, or implicit bias. And I think that may have more to do in, you know, what happens to you subsequently. Like, initially when trauma patients come in, there are a lot of protocols and people get very similar care. So it's difficult to imagine that there's a difference there. But
do they really get similar care? You know, when you talked about the story about the young lady who was shot and the care that she received subsequently when she was on the unit and, you know, she started showing signs of post-traumatic stress syndrome, it made me think about Eric Gardner and the YouTube clips that I saw with the chokehold and the pleas for him, you know, for him saying, "I can't breathe." And then looking at the EMT who did not immediately give oxygen and actually walked away with the oxygen. And it makes me wonder, what is going on in our minds that although we all, and I'm a nurse practitioner, you're a physician, a surgeon, we all enter into healthcare with the ideals and the belief that we're going to make a difference. We want to make a difference. But what happens that allows us, once we're in the thick of it, to be able to walk away from a patient like Eric Gardner and not give oxygen? Or the guy, Oscar Grant, who was involved in that police altercation at Fruitvale Station and was shot. And you didn't see anyone rescuing or coming to his aid. It blows my mind. So when I read your study that looked at the racial disparities, the unconscious race and social class bias, and you looked at whether unconscious bias was actually related to clinical decision making, although some studies say, yes, there is a relationship, your study did not find that. So I wanted to hear about that. But before you answer it, I just want to remind our listeners, I'm Kenya Beard, and you're listening to Health Cetera on WBAI. And joining me is Dr. Anil Haider, the trauma and critical care surgeon who has raised awareness regarding trauma-based disparities. So, Anil, what do you think about that? And tell us about that study that showed, you know, your physicians did not practice any differently among different races.
So thank you again, Kenya, for having me on your program, and welcome to all your listeners. Yes, you're correct. The studies that you're referring to did not show a relationship between how a person would potentially practice and their unconscious preferences in the surgical setting. But let me give you a little context and back up just a moment. You were asking about, do people really get the same care based on their race? I think one very important thing is geography. So where you are, it determines, you know, which kind of trauma center you go to. And we know for sure that trauma centers are of different levels and of different quality. So we know that of what are called level one trauma centers, which are the most advanced trauma centers, even between them, we've done many, many simulations, and we can show you that some trauma centers have much better outcomes, some trauma centers have much worse outcomes after doing all sorts of risk adjustment and so on. And turns out, and this is some other work we've done, which was very highly received, and some of the very senior leaders in American surgery have taken notice, shows that turns out that all the trauma centers that have the worst outcomes, where do you think they're located?
Inner city?
Yeah, they're the ones that take care of predominantly minority patients. So of the ones that do the worst, 85% of them have more than 50% minority patients or care for more than 50% minority patients. So that's a huge, huge problem. And I'm not saying, so first of all, that would include patients or trauma centers like, for example, Johns Hopkins, where I used to work. And we're not saying Johns Hopkins is a terrible trauma center. In fact, Johns Hopkins has fantastic outcomes.
That's right.
It's just that there are these very famous trauma centers, but along with them, there are a lot of other trauma centers which are not so famous, which are working in super duress conditions. I mean, there are no money. Most of the patients are uninsured. So, by the way, 50% minority patients, vast majority of trauma patients, nearly 75%, no insurance, right? So these trauma centers and hospitals are not getting any money for taking care of many patients. That makes them unable to improve their quality, do interventions, make things better. And there's this terrible spiral in which they're caring for the most difficult patients the most downtrodden patients, and then they don't have the resources to take care of them, right?
So but what you're saying is it's more than race alone. It's your race and where you live, and that the two factors right there are really going to determine the type of care or the quality of the care that you receive.
Or the
limited resources that the hospital may have.
Right. Like if you're shot on the south side of Chicago right now, where it's terrible violence, right, it takes you much longer to get to a trauma center because there's no trauma center in that area. And now I know there's plans to build one after the President Obama finishes his term and so on. But compared to, like, Boston, where I work now, there's six trauma centers in, like, literally a few miles within one another. And that's why after the Marathon bombing, or that's one of the credits to that, after the Marathon bombing, you know, they were able to triage all these patients so rapidly to places, and there was literally no loss of life. I mean, of course, some people died, but that was primarily right on the scene. But nobody died at the hospital. Almost nobody died at the hospital. And, you know, so that really makes a difference. And then you wanted to talk about subconscious preferences. What we found was, is that first we looked at medical students. And we gave, because we really wanted to go all the way back and see, you know, where this starts. And we looked at medical students and we found that they have unconscious preferences. So just like you said, you know, none of us go into medicine saying we're going to treat people differently. But we may have unconscious preferences that stem from our previous experiences and understandings of different people. And those unconscious preferences may lead us to do things differently, act differently. We know that if people are of a different race than us or different experience than us, than another person, for example, you know, you're less likely to hire that person. There's lots of studies to show that. Unless you do things to promote diversity and so on. And so the same thing we wanted to test in medicine and medical school, and we found that of about 200 medical students we looked at Johns Hopkins, they had about 70% of them preferred the white race on those on this thing called the implicit associated test. Now, initially, you would be surprised by that, right? 70% of them preferred white. But if you look at it, if you compare it to the million people in America who've taken a similar test, about 70% prefer white. And why is that? Because the country is not exactly, but kind of near 70% white. So if two-thirds of people are preferring the people who look like them, most social psychologists would say, yeah, no surprise there.
Right, I'm not surprised.
But
what does it mean? What does that mean?
Does it impact clinical care? And what we found for the medical students was that, no, it was not impacting clinical care when we tested it using clinical vignettes. We did the same thing for about 250 nurses. We did the same thing for about 250 fully qualified trauma surgeons, and then 250 surgical residents and trainees. From across the country, the trauma surgeons were, and the trainees were primarily at Johns Hopkins, and so the nurses were primarily at Johns Hopkins. And we found out that they had the same exact implicit or unconscious preferences. I mean, it was unbelievable to see that the medical students and the nurses and the doctors, everybody had nearly two-thirds preference of white. And now, understand, is this, you know, the makeup, the racial makeup of the medical school class is very different than the racial makeup of the nurses, which is very different than the racial makeup of the doctors. The doctors are mostly white. The nurses have a high influence of different diverse, of a very diverse
We're majority white, Bill.
Where?
In nursing, we're still majority white.
Yeah, yeah. But at Johns Hopkins, the cohort we had, you know, had a lot of diversity. And then the medical students have, you know, diversity. But, for example, only 8 out of 100, African-American students, but nearly 20 Asian-American students. So Asian-Americans are overrepresented in that sample. Anyway, I'm just showing you that no matter what sample you look at, you know,
the outcome was the same.
The outcome was the same. All right. But none of that impacted clinical care, which was at least on these clinical vignettes, or their assessment, which is different from what we found in the chronic care literature. And what I think, and my hunch is, the reason why this happened is because unconscious preferences, much like that young girl that I took care of, probably impact a lot when you have to make decisions and choices where you could really involve the patient and and understand how they're going to do stuff. So let me just back up for a moment. If I needed to treat somebody's blood pressure and I just told them, you know what, you should do so-and-so, without understanding what they're actually able to do, what they're able to eat, what they have access to, then, you know, I may not provide good enough care to that person. And there's good data to suggest that that occurs.
Right.
I mean, but when you have somebody who is shot or somebody who has acute surgical problem, and it's a very, you know, textbook response, protocolized response, then maybe unconscious preference doesn't creep in as much as it is when you have to really work with the patient and have a nuanced discussion to figure out how they're gonna take care of their health.
But how would that explain some of the literature that actually says that the implicit bias is more likely to manifest when you're stressed or in a high-pressured environment? And a trauma center, I would assume, is high-pressured, highly stressful.
Kenya, you could have been on the NIH study section that reviewed the grants that we put in to get this stuff funded. Because that's exactly what they agreed with. We wrote that our hypothesis was exactly what you're suggesting, that trauma centers would be at increased risk for unconscious preference because, you know, most trauma happens at night when people are, you know, tired and under a lot of pressure and there's mm-hmm. a lot of time pressure and so on. So I think we need to do more work, truth be told, to really understand the impact of unconscious preferences on trauma care and acute care. As I mentioned, you know, that was my hunch of what's happening because we can't prove anything just yet because the studies we did were based on clinical vignettes and, you know, basically scientific experiments versus actually observing what happens in real life. And the right way to do a study would be, you know, you look at people's, to observe them, you look at their preferences, and then you audio tape or videotape. And I think that's the right way to do it. And hopefully we'll be able to really do that. But how is that going to help us? Right, the way it's going to help us is if we could find out exactly where these things happen or what the problems are, does unconscious bias impact how we treat people, we can actually fix that problem.
Sure.
And you know how we can fix them?
How?
By giving people the tools to, A, navigate this. So there's a thing called cultural dexterity. Not cultural competency. I know a lot of people love to talk about cultural competency, but I, for one, believe that you can't be competent in another person's culture unless you literally live in that culture.
Right. And also, when we think about cultural competence, it really moves and really affects the explicit biases. And when we're talking about implicit biases, the cultural competence piece really doesn't have that type of effect that we want it to have. And
sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was saying, well, what it can do is, it can enable us to navigate. Like, if you become dexterous or able to navigate another person's culture better, you could, I believe, provide them much better care because you'll understand their perspective.
Yes.
And understanding another person's perspective is key. And my favorite study in all of the unconscious bias literature is there's a study amongst college students, and it shows that college students who are in, for example, fraternities and sororities of in a situation where they have a very homogeneous makeup of people they associate with on a routine basis and, you know, hang out with, basically, those young people have much more unconscious preferences towards minorities and people who don't look like them compared to college students who had a much more diverse group of friends. And that just makes so much sense, that if you have a lot of friends who are of different races and backgrounds, you get to know them and get to understand them and get their perspective where they're coming from versus
being in a homogeneous environment.
Right.
But that's why diversity is so key in institutions.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
everyone we know inherently, everyone's biased. So
right.
What do we actually need to do to eliminate it?
Well, I think a couple of things. First, as you said, promoting diversity and understanding other people's perspective. Just very briefly, you know, I always tried to understand why, you know, I never knew, much like the president, and I'm invoking him the second time today, you know, about marriage equality. But when I really sat down and spent time with my friends who happened to be gay, I understood that it's about normalization. That if you said to somebody that you're not married and you're a man and a man, and you have a civil union, then that's not normal, because in the world, normal, when people are in a loving relationship, they get to be married. And what people, what the LGBT community was talking about was normalization, you know? The fact that I'm lesbian or gay is a normal thing, and it is, you know, part of my demographic information, and that's it. It's not a special circumstance. It's not a thing that needs to have special notation. It's just normal. And but I understood that much better after spending time and understanding the different people's perspectives. And I can really relate to that and really, really believe it. And I think that's what needs to happen. We need to believe in why people are going to be different and then celebrate that differences among us, because as Americans, that's what really brings greatness to the country and brings all these common different perspectives that leads us to be able to achieve so many things that we've achieved as a nation.
Right. We only have a few minutes left. Again, I'm Kenya Beard, and you're listening to Health Cetera on WBAI. Joining me is Dr. Anil Haider, the trauma and critical care surgeon who is raising awareness regarding trauma-based disparities, the silent epidemic. And before I let you go, what advice will you give to our listeners so that they have a better opportunity to reach an optimal level of health?
Thank you much for having me on the show, Kenya. And it's such a pleasure to discuss this with your listeners. I would say three things for your listeners to make sure that you're getting the best possible care. Number one is choose your healthcare provider based on, you know, not just because somebody just recommended you go right to that person, but try to look up the person and understand what kind of patients they take care of. And if they take care of patients who have the problems that you have, then that's the person you want to go to, because we know that the more a person does something, the better they're at it. The second thing is, so let me just put that in perspective. So if you're going to go get, for example, bariatric surgery or a lap gastric bypass to reduce weight, and you're going, you know, go to somebody, and you happen to be African-American, go to somebody like Terrence Fulham, who practices at Howard University, has a lot of patients who happen to be African-American and does a fantastic job. I don't mean to just do a shout-out for this particular surgeon, but I'm just saying choose somebody who's taking care of people that have the same experiences and understanding that you have, because you're likely to get a better outcome if you go to a place with a high volume.
Not just do your research on the physician or the surgeon's credentials and their practice, but also have they treated patients that look like you, or will they be able to treat someone who looks like you?
Yep. That certainly helps. The second thing is don't hesitate to ask questions. You know, there are places where you can find out the questions to ask. Don't hesitate. Ask and ask and ask away. And if somebody doesn't want to, especially if you're going to a surgeon, somebody doesn't have the time, you know, to answer your questions, well, then they don't have the time to operate on you. And you should be completely comfortable. And never should there be a question in your mind about, well, what is this supposed to happen or that supposed to happen?
Good point.
And then third thing is have an advocate. Have an advocate that will kind of be your buddy in your healthcare journey. And be somebody who is kind of knowledgeable, potentially, and if you don't have somebody who's knowledgeable in healthcare, maybe somebody who's knowledgeable in just trying to navigate the world. And don't try to do it alone. Ask for help and try to, figure out things. But don't let things happen to chance. Oh, well, that's what they told me. I don't really understand how to take the medicine or what to do. Well, then let's find out how to take the medicine, for example. You know, ask the pharmacist. You know, I stand in the line at the pharmacy, and every time the pharmacist says, would you like to have information on this procedure? And you probably don't, and so please sign here. I mean, there's a reason why they officially have to have you sign a piece of thing saying that you declined counseling or you got the counseling.
Or you understand what you're going to take.
Yeah, 90% of people decline it, right? But that's an obvious service that you have. Take advantage of that. So just to recap, you know, go to a surgeon who does a lot of what you need. Don't hesitate to ask as many questions. And if somebody doesn't have the time to ask questions, then don't think they have the time to operate on you. And third, have a buddy to help you navigate the process. In most instances, two minds are better than one.
Wow. Thank you so, so much for all of this information regarding trauma-based disparities, the silent epidemic. This is amazing. I am so pleased and honored to have had you on HealthCetera. You are the man who is responsible for a lot of the attention around trauma-based disparities, and for that, I thank you. I thank you because we need to make sure that our listeners moving forward can take back some control of their health care. I know they might not be able to say which facility they're going to go to when they're in the midst of a traumatic injury. I know they might not have the ability to say, I want to go here or there because of the acuteness of their needs. But once they're out of that critical period, we need to make sure that, and again, I think about your story about the young lady and our quick assumption to believe that someone is ungrateful rather than exploring. And I thank you for taking the time and the effort to explore.
And my pleasure. And I wanted to just congratulate you on your excellent program and the important work you're doing. You know, for people, it's very important to know how to navigate the complex healthcare system and achieve better health. So congratulations on all the work you've been doing, Kenya.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And I hope to speak to you again soon. Have a great afternoon.
Sure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Since the landmark report, Unequal Treatment, Confronting Racial and Ethnic Disparities in Healthcare by Smedley, Stith, and Nelson, we are seeing that the dimensions of healthcare disparities are exceedingly complex. But that's not to say that ending healthcare disparities is beyond our reach. Researchers like Dr. Dana Bowen Matthews, the author of Just Medicine, and Dr. Anil Hader, the prolific researcher, they are moving the needle closer to health equity. And one day, everyone will receive quality care regardless of your socioeconomic status or the color of your skin. I want to thank Anil again. Thank you so much. And thank the listeners. Again, this is Kenya Beard, and you were listening to HealthCetera on WBAI. Have a great afternoon.